A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, writer and cultural critic John Higgs returns to Little Atoms to talk about his latest book, Watling Street. John Higgs is the author of I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary, The KLF, Chaos, Magic and the Band Who Burned £1 Million, Stranger Than We Can Imagine, Making Sense of the 20th Century, which listeners will remember we talked about on a previous Little Atoms, and the novels The Brandy and the Damned and The First Church on the Moon. And his latest book, Watling Street, we're going to be talking about today. John, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Hello, Neil.
What's the idea behind Watling Street then? How did this one come about?
Well, it's a journey across the country. Watling Street, if you don't know what it is, it's a road that goes from Dover up through London, through the Midlands into North Wales and ultimately onto Anglesey. But it's a road that's always been there. It's like one of the one constants in, you know, British history. I mean, we talk of it as a Roman road. It's far older than that. You know, we don't know how old it is. That's how old it is. But it's essentially, if you think back to the, to after the Ice Age, when this was all forests, you know, and you think of the first footprints going through the primordial sort of landscape, probably not even human footprints, you know, probably like little snuffling pig-like creatures, like finding the dry ground, the higher paths and things like that, and people coming along following their tracks, and those tracks becoming paths, and those paths becoming roads, and then, you know, the Romans straightening them and them becoming royal highways and then turnpikes, and now that's the A2 and the A5. Mm-hmm. They've always been there. As I say, it's this sort of one sort of constant, and it struck me that there was nothing more neutral than a road. Right, there's no politics to a road. It doesn't care who's travelling along it. If you told the story of a road, you get a vision of this country that's, you know, very different to the one we're sort of taught at school, and hopefully more useful. So that was the reasoning.
And there's a network is probably overdoing it, but there's a number of these roads: the Foss Way, the McNeild Way, the Ridgeway.
Yeah.
Why Watling Street in particular?
Well, it was the name, to be honest. I just loved the name. It's not that I went away and researched which was the most interesting, which was the most drenched in, you know, history and things like that. It might be that the Foss Way is the one. You know, I don't know. There was just something about the name Watling Street. It's got a certain understated British sort of magic to it. I mean, if you look in stories about Roman Britain, they'll always refer to Watling Street, but the name comes from the Dark Ages. It's much, much later. It came from around the St. Albans area. Mm-hmm. But there was just something about it that spread, and it spread as far south as Canterbury, as far north as Shrewsbury. It sort of went back in time to the Roman sort of thing. So basically, I'm just taking that name and applying it to the A2 and the A5. There's a certain appeal to the name that I can't quite put my finger on.
And you said you chose a road. The idea of basing the book around the road gives it a sort of neutral quality. And the idea about the book is you're basically travelling up that road and, I guess, trying to get to the root of Englishness, Britishness, some sort of identity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I did this in 2016. Mm. Most of it was written in 20... You'll remember 2016. It was a bit grim for pretty much everyone. You know, there's this anger everywhere on social media, and, you know, there was families were split, young kids were angry about their grandparents over, you know, over Brexit and all this thing, and it was there was a sense that our notion of geographic identity wasn't working, that it had cracked, that it would sort of split. And I think I was very lucky to be writing this book that year, because everywhere I was looking, I wasn't finding stories of anger or division. I was finding stories of how we transcend division. It was a theme that sort of kept coming up again and again and again, this sort of that we have the ability to transcend division on this island. And in many ways, divisions are an important sort of part of us. It made me feel much more positive doing this book at that time. You know, it's not a book for people who want to be proud to be British, right? But it's it certainly made me delighted to be British.
That very idea, I think, you say British, and I'm thinking more in terms of English, obviously. The very idea to me of like an English identity is a bit queasy in the way that I can't really think of anybody else who has that sort of feeling.
Yeah, definitely.
Again, certainly, like, you know, thinking of somebody else who might think, like Americans, for instance, certainly don't have anywhere near the trouble with their own identity that I think a lot of English people do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, for me, I was born in Rugby. I was born on Watling Street, or very close to Watling Street. But I was raised in North Wales. Mm-hmm. So I sort of come from this borderland. So you're sort of betwixt and between. And when you're from the borders, the notion that they're a real thing that exists just seems ludicrous to you, right? Yeah. The notion that, you know, at some point, you know, Welshness stops and Englishness starts. It's just ridiculous. There's everywhere is this sort of shifting sort of patchwork sort of clouds. Obviously, the coast is a good boundary. Rivers can be a good boundary. There are natural sort of boundaries, but they're not sort of on land. There is something kind of ridiculous about borders, you know. And if your sense of identity is based on which side of the field you started on, right, you've missed the point of pride. You know, pride is a very important attribute for us. We need pride, but pride has to come from our actions, from our relationships. It has to come from what we've done. It's not if you're just saying, I'm proud because these other people who lived years ago did great things and therefore I'm proud of that. You've completely missed the point of pride.
But Welsh people are proud of being Welsh, and rightly so, frankly. Ooh. You know, there's not that same thing with the Irish, Scottish and the Welsh. All have an identity.
Yeah.
There's something about, first of all, Englishness that just seems weird and creepy, but also about the identity of Britishness, because that's a thing that's just like forced upon those other nations. It's a thing that's cobbled together through political allegiances and things, and it's not a real thing you can grab hold of.
Yeah, I mean, basically, we're all kin on a rock, you know. We're all, it's this damp, wet island in the North Atlantic. We all live on here, and we have to sort of get by as best we can. And I think the important thing about this sense of, you know, national geographic identity is that it's always a work in progress, right? There was never like a time at a certain point in history, say whatever year you think, where we had it right, you know, where the nature of who we were was decided and it became a fixed thing, and that every generation that sort of comes after that has to live in, like, you know, a heritage park version of how it used to be. It's not the case. It's a thing that we're constantly working on and evolving and changing and making it suit us at this particular point in history. And if it doesn't, right, if your sense of national identity is something that's problematic or damaging to you in some way, you just haven't done the work. You need to sort of go back. You need to go back and look at the history and the people before you and things like that. Because it's not so much about... There's so much history in this country, right? The soil is so rich and so fertile that our identity is really an editing job. You know, it's what we choose to focus on. You can focus on other things. You can focus on other versions. And I think this is what I was trying to do in this book, was just to look again and find a sense of Britishness that I thought was positive and that sort of sustains me and things. Because we, you know, we are from a place. I mean, I noticed this when I did my last book, Strange to Imagine. It was great because I got to go abroad quite a bit. I went to Canada, went to Spain for the various things. And, you know, international publishers treat you like royalty. It's fantastic. I've never had anything like it. But they'd be like, oh, can I get you a drink? And I'd go, oh, lovely, can I have a cup of tea? And they just sort of laugh, right? Because the notion of me asking for a cup of tea was so stereotypically British in their eyes that it was funny. And part of me wants to go, but no, tea is the best drink, right? It's, you know, really, it's rationally the best drink. But I know deep down that these things that I think are important parts of my identity, the music I like, the comedy I like, the drinks I like, you know, I haven't rationally sort of chosen them. You know, there's a large part of my identity. It's almost like a sort of an add-on, a sort of a bionic arm or something that comes from the place that you've grown up with.
And tea, of course, is a classic example of something that's like, you can't think too deeply about it because you tie yourself up in all sorts of ethical knots if you actually do.
And it was bizarre. Where was I? I was in Greece on a holiday a few weeks ago, and all the tea was marked as like English tea or London tea or something like that. And you just think, that's very odd for a drink from India, as it was in the tea I was having. But it's become so much part of our identity. I think tea is a good thing to include in our identity. You know, I'm all for it. The more tea, the better. That's not something I'd overlook and choose something more.
I'm Alex Cox, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Thinking about the idea then of identity as not necessarily this idea of sort of shared, you know, characteristics or values or something, but as a shared cultural heritage and history. Mm. You talk about this concept, the noosphere. Mm. Tell us about the noosphere, what you mean by that.
Yeah, or the noosphere. I think it's noosphere would be more fun, but I think it's noosphere. I talked about a similar concept in a previous book. I think it's a book about the KLF. Mm-hmm. And I used the phrase idea space for this, which comes from Alan Moore and Stephen Moore.
Yeah.
But I chose the word noosphere for this book, partly because Alan Moore is in the book.
And
Steve Moore is, of course he is, yes. Because it's more grounded in place. The thinking was that there were sort of concentric sort of spheres. At the base of it would be the geosphere. This is the world of physical mineral and rock and stuff. So we've got the geosphere. And arising out of the geosphere comes the biosphere, which is living matter. And living matter, the biosphere, it evolves and changes quicker than the geosphere, but it is very much based in the geosphere. But then you can go further up, which is what Deschardin did, which is out of the biosphere arises the noosphere, which is the world of ideas, basically. It's of laws and languages and culture and songs and histories and stories and things like anything immaterial. Mm-hmm. That's the noosphere. And the reason I loved it was so clearly linked to the geosphere, you know, in the terminology. And any journey, and this is the thing I sort of learned from reading Ian Sinclair, I suppose, and any journey is not just through the physical streets, it's through the immaterial version of them as well. You're as much affected by the histories and the associations and the stories as you are about the real thing. I've just walked up to the studio from St Pancras Station. We're in London. It's just a bit up York Way. And I used to know this area very, very well. And it's utterly different now. It's entirely... It's safe for a start. It never used to be safe. It's full of, like, prosperous, happy people sort of walking around. It was a real wasteland when I sort of knew this. And I couldn't walk up to your studio without all the former associations and things applying to it and things like that. So a journey across Britain, as I do here, is as much a journey through the Albion noosphere as it is the A2, the mundanity of the A2 and the A5.
Well, let's take the journey up Watling Street then, checking out the British noosphere as we go along. And actually, the book starts roughly halfway along, shall we say, in Milton Keynes.
The introduction is in Milton Keynes. Yeah. No, Milton Keynes is great. It's such a perfect example of what I was, you know, hoping to achieve with the book, is that when we think of Milton Keynes, most people who don't live in Milton Keynes, that is, have quite a negative association of it as this sort of concrete, bland, corporate world of roundabouts and cars and things like that. And people who live in Milton Keynes love it, right, as far as I can tell. It's people there are really sort of happy. But it's this 1960s new town. It's the biggest of them. You know, it was a quarter of a million people it was built to house in the 1960s. Designed in the 1960s, and that was the white heat of technology. The space race was on, and this was the future. Hence, it's done on this very sort of rational American style grid system with roads running vertically, starting with the letter V, and roads running horizontally, starting with the letter H. It's rational and it's logical, and yet it's been dumped on, you know, Britain, where things like rational planning and things just don't really work. It's very, very odd. And you look at Milton Keynes, and a lot of people don't realise that it was designed as a pagan sun temple. It's the last thing people notice about it. But that's exactly what it was. It was the 1960s. The chief architect was a guy called Derek Walker. He was very much into Pink Floyd. His obituary, and I think it was The Guardian, quotes him as saying of those times that they were very kinky. Right? And I don't know how many obituaries you've read of chief architects, but it's a phrase you don't get very often, you know. And they were very. There was a book by Jean Michel, A View Over Atlantis, which was a real counterculture sort of classic at the time, about, you know, ancient Albion and Silbury and, you know, our ancient past. Mm-hmm. And they were reading this, and the notion that, well, maybe this new town that we're building, maybe we could align it to the rising sun on the midsummer solstice so that it emerges at the end of this middle road, which we'll call Midsummer Road, and sends light all the way down to the railway station at the other end, which is all glass and mirrored and sort of lights up the connection to the rest of the world, so that the town works exactly like Stonehenge, right? Struck them as a very good idea. So there they were 50 years ago, out in the mud in the fields with ropes and wooden sticks, paving out this central road, Midsummer Boulevard, waiting for the sunrise on the shortest day. And the sun rose up and they were able to plot it all out. And then they based the rest of the grid system around it. So the whole city is based around this alignment on the longest day. And the reason they could do that was because most cities on a grid system run north, south, east, west. Mm-hmm. But was one road that was already there, which is Watling Street. Of course it was already there. It's always been there, right? But it was an angle. So they had to sort of canter or shift the whole grid system to fit in with Watling Street, which coincidentally allowed them to align the whole thing up, you know, with the rising sun on the midsummer solstice. So I'm talking all about those, you know, those Neolithic feet padding through the forests, you know, making these tracks. Those were still affecting the creation of a quarter of a million houses in the 20th century. The past and the present are not as separate as we often like to think, you know.
Listen to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to John Higgs, and we're talking about his latest book, Watling Street. And John, we're going to properly start at the beginning of the road now, and we'll head down to Dover, a place that has certainly its cliffs, if not the town itself, which is perhaps not quite so fondly thought of. Has a very firm place in this, you know, idea of our own identity, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's almost overwhelming, really. It's very hard to stand on those cliffs and not... I mean, they are beautiful. It is a beautiful, you know, part of the country. But you're not really looking at that. You're hearing Vera Lynn. You're thinking of the Spitfires going over, you know, the Armada. The Spanish Armada would have passed in front, you know. I talk in the book about this. There was a Doctor Who filmed in the castle there. The James Bond was based or was written just further along the coast. Shakespeare wrote about those cliffs. Winston Churchill was on those cliffs. It's almost too much. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got so many deeply patriotic associations with those cliffs. It's almost overwhelming. You know, it's almost a bit too much to deal with. Yeah. And, you know, I start the book going down into them, deep down into the World War II tunnel system.
All through the book, there are characters that, historical figures and mythical or fictional characters, a number of which we'll touch on. And there becomes as you talk about in the book, you know, history, the mists of time have like clouded some of these people. So the idea of whether or not these people really existed, or, you know, the ones that perhaps are fictional are the people that we know more about than the actual real people. And the first one of these people that I want to talk about is Vortigern.
Yeah.
He's a 5th century British king.
Yes.
So tell us something about who he was.
Well, he was real, as generally accepted that he did exist. Now, if you read most of the stories about him, you might think otherwise, because they're full of wizards, they're full of dragons, they're great. It's basically Game of Thrones. If Game of Thrones was a documentary, it would be about Vortigern. He's probably best known for inviting the first of the Anglo-Saxons over as mercenaries to I think, was it the Scottish were invading, or there was some invasion on at the time. So he got a bunch of guys over from Denmark. They sorted it out. He said, have the Isle of Thanet as a thank you. And they went, wow, it's nice here, isn't it? Let's tell our mates. And the whole of the Anglo-Saxon sort of invasion began because of that. So that was almost his... that sort of runs through the rest of his life story. That was his great failing that he's desperately trying to sort of make amends of. But I talk with him in Kent, but I also pick him up when I'm in Snowdonia.
Yeah.
And the story in Snowdonia is wonderful. At this point, he'd built a tower. He wanted to build a tower on Dimas Emrys, which is in the foothills of Snowdonia. And every night, the workers would come back in the morning and find that the tower had collapsed every night, and they couldn't work out why this was happening. So they thought, "Well, we'll get a druid. We'll ask a druid." And the druid goes, I know what you need. You need get a fatherless boy, right? Get a fatherless boy. Sacrifice the fatherless boy. Put the blood in the foundations. It will be fine." And Vortigern goes, okay, well, we'll best find a fatherless boy then. And as luck would have it, along comes a fatherless boy who turned out to be Merlin, right? Merlin is the sort of... it's a set category of historical and mythical figures who are fatherless. And it's like it's everyone from, like, Hercules, Jesus, Darth Vader, Merlin. It's a certain category. He was one of these. And Merlin goes, oh, no, that's just... Robert, he didn't want to be sacrificed for this tower, you see.
Fair enough. He goes,
that's totally wrong what they're telling you. I know I'm just a kid, but listen, drill down into the top of the hill, you'll find a lake, right? Look in the lake, you'll find two vases, right? Open up the vases. Those are the reasons why your tower will not stand. And they go, okay, so they do this. They find the lake, they find the vase, they open up, and these two dragons come roaring out and flying through the air. And there's a red dragon and a white dragon. They're fighting and they're clawing at each other. And dragons in those days weren't the sort of butt of the joke as they sort of become. After St. George, a dragon is there for a rich guy to kill to look impressive. It's like a fool guy for like some rich lord. At that point, dragons are much more seen in the way they're still seen in the East. These sort of these really elemental, awesome... I mean, they're the spirits of the people, essentially. The dragon is the spirit of the people. So the notion that a rich guy stabs it and looks good is, you know, very, very dodgy. Very pro-dragon, you understand. And so there's the red dragon is the spirit of the Brythonic people, the British people, and the white dragon is the Anglo-Saxons, who Vortigern invited because they were still fighting. And that's why his tower wouldn't stand. And I got very sort of fascinated with this image of this red and this white dragon tumbling around each other. And it started to remind me of the Tudor rose, which becomes a very important a symbol in this book, because it's, as I was saying earlier, it's a symbol about transcending division. It's after the Wars of the Roses, they'd gone for decades, you know, so much bloodshed had been spilt on both sides that it didn't look like there was ever any hope of any sort of reconciliation, you know. But after Henry Tudor defeated Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth, further down Watling Street, they came up with this wonderful... It was just a symbol, the symbol of the Tudor rose. It had the white rose of York in the centre, surrounded by the red rose, which represents the Lancastrians, a little ahistorically, but it was good enough for Shakespeare, so that's okay for me. And what this symbol was, it wasn't favouring one side over the other. It wasn't denying either side. It wasn't raising one above the other. It just found a perspective that included both sides and showed them to be part of something larger and more important, right? And that's always how we transcend division. It's basically, it was a Tudor Good Friday Agreement. It's exactly like the Good Friday Agreement. It didn't, you know, marginalise one side, it didn't raise one above the other. It's the way it always is. It's the way it always goes. So, yeah, I've gone slightly off the point about Vortigern, but the...
Well, we'll come back to Vortigern, because I was just going to say, we envisioned that we would start in Dover and sort of gradually work our way up towards Snowdonia, but actually I think we're going to clock up more miles and we'll go backwards and forwards up and down the road. And I grew up in Leicester. Leicestershire, so I spent a lot of my childhood romping around Naseby and the battle and the Bosworth battlefield. And in fact, you talk about another battle that happened somewhere at Watling Street, literally the Battle of Watling Street.
Oh yes, yeah, Boudicca. We don't quite know where the Battle of Watling Street is.
Well, we presume it was somewhere nearby.
Well, it's
somewhere up the length.
It's quite frustrating because there was an argument that it was back pretty much here where we are now, just by St Pancras Station, as you said. There's Battlebridge moorings on the canal, and it's now generally accepted it was much further north. But it's a shame because the Boudicca could have, met her end at platform 13 3/4, and combining the Harry Potter and the whole sort of, that would have been a lovely, lovely sort of bit of Britishness. But no, it was probably further up. I suspect probably around Watford Gap or somewhere like that. But that was a real changing point in history. It seems there have been more people killed on that day than at any point up until about the First World War. It was a real violent, bloody massacre, and it was a surprise on many levels that the Romans won, because the British Boudicca's British forces had been defeating Roman legions and things like that. It was a real sort of turning point, and I strongly suspect that it's a lot to do with the fact that they'd wiped out the Druid heartland on Anglesey,
all the way back up the road,
to Anglesey. Which is where they'd come, and so going back and forth. The amount of battles on Watling Street is because if you want to have a battle, you need to get your armies together. Mm-hmm. So you talked about Naseby, you talked about Bosworth Field. They're all on these blood-soaked sort of roads. Yeah.
So all the way back up to Snowdonia again, where we left Vortigern, and as you said, Merlin. And of course, Merlin, then, King Arthur, there's another one of these figures, although not necessarily associated with Watling Street, but we'll just take a sort of sidestep to say, here's a classic example of one of these was-he-mythical, was-he-not figures that's, firmly embedded in the British noosphere.
Yeah, and Watling Street can work as a dividing line across the country. A road connects, but it also divides at the same time. Almost literally, in the Watling Street case, all the rivers, sort of the north, flow into the North Sea and things like that, and all the rivers to the south and the west flow out separately. It's the sort of the river basin, and to the north and east of Watling Street is very much the territory of Robin Hood, whereas to the south and the west is much more King Arthur's sort of territory. And they're sort of opposites, really. They're both folk heroes. But Robin Hood was the man of the... He was the people. That was the whole point of him. He was the man of the people. It was changed. It was changed to make him an earl or Lord Loxby or something like that, because if someone was doing great things, that they had to be, they couldn't have been a commoner. Oh, no. So the whole point of him was he's a commoner. He's a yeoman anyway. He was a man of the people. Whereas the folk hero on the other side of Watling Street... is so much King Arthur, which is much more about duty and about honour and about chivalry and things like that. So they're very much opposite, and I think they balance each other quite well, Robin Hood and King Arthur.
And I mean, the same thing happens with Shakespeare. There's all of this nonsense about Shakespeare, not being the person that wrote his plays. Is this idea that somebody who was a commoner from the Midlands couldn't necessarily have done that.
And it had to be a lord. Or possibly six lords. That's whatever the theory is. Obviously somebody wrote those plays, right? So it's conceivable that there was someone of that genius. And it's very noticeable that the argument, yes, but they can't just have been a merchant son. They had to be, they had to be aristocrat. It runs deep in this country.
And you talk about the way that the Robin Hood story has been sort of like sanitised, sort of neutered, makes him into a... he was probably some lord that had been dispossessed by King John because, he was not a revolutionary, but he was somebody who was for the good king, who was Richard, who was obviously, I'm sure, no more of a good king than John was.
Yeah, the idea that John was terrible and Richard Lionheart was wonderful is not one that many medieval scholars would sort of have a lot of time for. But it was sort of retrofitting Robin, who was this spirit of the woods, the spirit of the common man. Because the first people to write down these stories, were probably to do with the church or some wealthy institution. There were the few people who could sort of write. So the stories, as soon as the ballads got sort of written down, they became suitable for the people who are writing them down. So you can really sort of see that shift. But no, the whole point of Robin Hood was he was just this bloke from this country mucking around in the woods with his mates having a great time. That's the heart of it. The story where, you know, he meets a guy go across the river on a fallen tree. So they have a fight and he loses and he thinks it's brilliant, so they become firm friends. That's very much Robin Hood. You know, that's very much the story. The notion that he's a noble lord is really not part of it.
I'm Hannah Fry. You're listening to Resonance FM and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Well, staying with Robin Hood for a minute, I mean, another one of these characters that's again, a real character this time that seems to have disappeared into the mist of time and has become mythical, and is possibly one of the models of Robin Hood, is Herod the Waif.
Yeah,
who was
he? Well, Herod was one of the... He was, after the Norman invasion, after William the Bastard, as was, becomes William the Conqueror, he was one of the major leaders of the ongoing British rebellion. He would... they were supposed to like basically guerrilla forces fighting the Normans. Mm-hmm. He would often disappear into the marshes around East Anglia or to the east of the country, which is very difficult for the Normans to sort of follow him and find him in that sort of territory. There's the brilliant story of how the Normans couldn't find him, so they put up some witch towers, which is like a tower, right, with a witch on the top. And the witch shouts out curses, right? And you just think, wow, how different warfare would have been if witch towers had caught on. But they didn't catch on because it turns out they're very easy to burn down. You know, one flaming arrow and your witch tower's sort of gone. So that was a bit of a blind alley in military evolution. But yeah, I mean...
Also happens to Vortigern.
Yes, his tower burned down. Yeah. At the end of his life, at the very end of his life. Which I think was when he was being pursued by Uther Pendragon, if my memory's right. Yeah. But there's no witch on the top of that one, which is the detail I particularly like. Herod the Waif, last of the English, as he was named in a novel. He's a very, very interesting figure. But we're usually quite good at glamorising these sort of, I don't know, freedom fighters or whatever you wish to call them. Boudicca, absolutely no problem. When the Romans invaded, she attacked the Romans. She failed, but she's still a hero. King Arthur, when the Anglo-Saxons came in, you know, he failed, but he's still a hero. Something about Herod we ignore because it was after the Normans invaded and they're still pretty much in power, you know. So we have to sort of avoid him slightly. But he should be remembered in exactly the same way as Boudicca and King Arthur.
See, I think what's really interesting about these particular characters being the ones we talk about is, you know, as we all know, Britain is this country of repeated waves of invasion and immigration.
Absolutely.
Over the years.
Absolutely.
And so realistically, I have no idea of who I'm descended from.
Yeah.
So
And if you were to get a DNA test, you'd probably be very... So everyone's just shocked. It's like, how am I from Greenland?
I've had one of those DNA tests related to the radio show because we advertised one of those companies on it, and so I got one of those free DNA tests. I was unsurprisingly, you know, ridiculously high percentage of Northern European.
Yeah.
But more interestingly, was in the top 1% of people for having a high percentage of Neanderthal, which I found very
excellent. Yeah. You're proud of your Neanderthal.
Yeah, I'm very much so. That made me really pleased. That was the best thing. That's the one thing I can really remember.
Yeah.
You know, it tells you whether you've got, I don't know, sticky or dry earwax or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? The thing that I cared about most was the high percentage of Neanderthal. That made me really like, you know, so I care about Neanderthal rights and everything now.
Obviously. Excellent.
I don't want to big up my Neanderthal.
Yeah. I mean,
heritage.
We are an absolute mongrel people. To the extent that the Aboriginal British, right, the first people sort of on this island, we just don't talk about them.
No, you know, we have no idea who they are.
We talk about the Celts, right, but they were invaders. You know, the Celtic invaders came and sort of pushed away the original sort of British people who have left, you know, wonderful markers across this island, stones and interesting sort of things. There is evidence of them, but because they weren't, you know, a strange mishmash of immigration and things like that, weirdly, there's something un-British about them. You know, they were just too British to be. They were pure British, so therefore, then there's nothing British about them. It's very weird the way we ignore them.
And I was going to say, because I have no idea where I'm descended from in that respect, I don't really get why, you know, I'm supposed to favour Harold and not William, for instance. You know what I mean? I don't understand why one's obviously is the loser, but, you know, why is one the hero and one not? And the story that made me think of that most of all in this book was the story of, I was going to say Hagrid. No, it's obviously not Hagrid. Hengist. Who's, there's this meeting, the sort of like proto Knight of the Long Knives.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's the bad guy because he's the trickster, whereas, you know, there's loads of other cultures around the world that like revere Norse cultures and, you know, Indo-American cultures have these sort of like trickster gods and trickster sort of deities and things. And, and here's this guy who basically wins because of cunning, not because of like...
Yeah,
I think he seemed to me the hero.
The story you're referring to was there was a giant tent, I think, on the Marlborough Downs.
Salisbury Plain. Somewhere around there.
As a peace treaty between the British people, or the Celtic people, or whatever you'd call them, and the Anglo-Saxons coming in. And this was Vortigern again, you know. And the idea was they all went and sit in a circle, all these various chieftains, and they sort of sat alternate, so there'd be an Anglo-Saxon next to a Brit, next to an Anglo-Saxon next to a Brit. Because it was a peace talk, and all the weapons had been left outside. But as it turned out, that the Anglo-Saxons had knives, really long knives in their boots. In fact, the name Saxon comes from these long knives. And at a certain point, Hengist called out for all the Saxons to sort of pull out their knives and stab the British. But it's this great betrayal, and we see it even in Game of Thrones, the Red Wedding. It's sort of an updating of that original idea. And I think Vortigern was kidnapped and was continued. He had quite a life, did Vortigern. Yeah. But you know, just to sort of favour one side over the other just does become quite ludicrous. You know, after a while, to say one side is better or right or something like that, it totally falls apart. You know, when you look again at your history, you can be brought up to be told that, you know, the Normans are the civilizing sort of force and things like that, but if you look at the history, it's
although the harrowing of the north and everything,
they were not nice people, but nobody was this is true, but they were particularly not nice. Yeah, the harrowing of the north was.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Little Atoms. I'm Neo Denny. Today I'm talking to John Higgs. We're talking about Watling Street, his latest book. And John, we're going to fly right back down towards the beginning of the road again now to Canterbury.
Mm.
Canterbury, which appears in this book in numerous guises, the approach to Canterbury, Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales, the Powell and Pressburger movie,
mm-hmm.
A Canterbury Tale. And The murder of Thomas Becket as well.
Yeah.
Thomas Becket, why is he not called Thomas A. Becket anymore?
It's a shame, isn't it? I quite like Thomas A. Becket, but, you know...
It's what I grew up with.
Yeah. People, you know, preferred Boadicea to Boudicca. Yeah. But then we go, oh, that's not their name. It's just got that sort of wrong.
Where did that come from?
Well, the great thing about history was, you know, certainly spelling a name wasn't a set sort of way, and sort of saying a name was... The further you go back, was much more varied and things like that. So how William Shakespeare would have, you know, spelt his name, no one knows. It was just it changed all the time, and these names can shift about quite a bit. Yeah.
The Canterbury. Let's talk about Canterbury itself, the cathedral, its city, and again its place in our sort of long and illustrious history.
Mm. Yeah, and you know Thomas Becket is. It's interesting that he's so important to us. We all know the story of Thomas and Henry and how King Henry had to humiliate himself, you know, in front of the tomb of Thomas Becket after he'd been killed. Not so much on his orders, but after he exclaimed something about a troublesome priest and he was killed, and then it was generally perceived that the sin was on him. It's an interesting story that there have been archbishops killed other than Thomas. So it's not the fact that it was necessarily just that he was an archbishop that had been killed that makes him so important. I think it's because he was... it's not fair to say he was a commoner. He was from Norman descent, so he'd been in the upper classes. But he was basically from the streets of London. You know, he was very low down compared to the king, you know. And so to become the friend of the king... and be raised by the king and treated as an equal, and then to decide after he becomes Archbishop of Canterbury that he's not equal to the king. He's got a higher calling. You know, he has this... he will not do what the king says, even if it means his own death, and turns him into a saint, which raises him higher than a king. I think there's a lot of interesting things in the story of Thomas about power and about the relationship between the spiritual... and the political, which is what I talk about a lot in that chapter. They're two things usually don't go together, right? You find people who are very political and people who are very spiritual, and there's a sense that the political is you know too practical and hard nosed and nasty, whereas the spiritual is all too fluffy and meaningless and sort of disappear. So when they come together, it's very very interesting. The people who are active politically because of a sense of spirituality, people like Martin Luther King, people like Gandhi, there's a real power to them. There's a real shift. I compare the story of Thomas and Henry to the story of Tony Blair and Brian Hall.
Yeah.
Now, you might remember Brian Hall. He was the guy, he was an evangelical Christian. He's got links to Whitstable. He's actually from the Midlands, but he's got links to Whitstable. And when the sanctions first kicked in, this is before the Iraq War, there was all the stories about the children in Iraq being killed because of these sanctions. He just couldn't live with it. He just couldn't live with these Iraqi children dying from a sense of his Christianity. He sort of left home, he left his family, and he moved to Westminster Square and set up a tent and just stayed there. Mm. And obviously once the war in Iraq kicked off, he was against that as well, you know. But it was just this real sort of spiritual need, the spiritual necessity that you don't get from normal political activists. And it's interesting to see this recur again and again and again in the story. You know, you go to Canterbury on a pilgrimage to the shrine of Thomas, but you can just go a bit further up to Whitstable, and there's a peace bench, a Brian Hall peace bench on the Stephen. That becomes the sort of modern day place that you'll go to. And I the notion that one day Tony Blair might humble himself in front of the grave of Brian Hall in the way that King Henry humbled himself in front of the grave of Thomas Becket is a tantalising one, I think. We will see. We'll see what happens.
Let's head back up the road a bit in the direction of London. And I'd like if you were to tell us what connection there is between Charles Dickens and an emu.
Yes, we're talking about Great Expectations. And you'll remember Great Expectations of Miss Havisham in her faded gown knocking around this decaying old Gothic house. And it was quite a surprise for me to realise that's a real house. It's in my imagination. It's too unreal to be a real place. And when you find yourself standing right in front of it, it's kind of odd. It's like fiction and reality sort of merging. And it is in Rochester, and it's just about 50 yards from from Watling Street, and it only exists, only stands there now because of Rod Hull and Emu. Mainly Rod Hull.
Yeah, I mean, Emu didn't really have that much involvement.
Yeah, it was going to be knocked down to be a car park. And a local boy, Rod Hull, big fan of Dickens, was in a position to go, no, I'll buy it and I'll restore it. And he did that. And him and his wife moved in, and he started to pour all his money into restoring this house because he loved Dickens. And then his series was cancelled, and there was the late 80s property crash, and the house was taken off him by the tax people, and he was made bankrupt, and he ended his days in paying 25 quid rent in this wee cottage down in.
And his wife left him.
His wife left him. She took the kids.
Ironically, Dickensian
Australia.
Story.
Yeah, it was really, really good. So we have him to thank. But it's odd knowing that story, because now it's hard for me to imagine Mish Havisham in a house without Rod Hull and Emu there as well. You know, the Emu pecking at that wedding cake decaying, or pecking at her veils. They've sort of merged in my head. It's not true that that was the house he died falling off the roof, fixing the aerial from, which sometimes people get a bit confused. That would have been really bizarre if Rod Hull had been killed falling off the roof of Miss Havisham's house from Great Expectations. That would be very, very strange. Yeah. But that's the sort of detail you find if you look in this country. There's so much unexpected. There's so much history, and there's so many things have happened that you're going to get these sort of really sort of ludicrous juxtapositions of, you know, Rod Hull and Miss Havisham. Sort of again. Yeah, I love it.
Moving a little bit further up further up Watling Street towards London, and we approach London via Shooter's Hill. It's the first time we hear mentioned in this book of Dick Turpin, the famous highwayman has become highwayman of myth and legend now, even though of course it turns out that he was not a particularly nice chap.
No, he wasn't. This is very true.
And Highwaymen and highwaywomen feature further up the road as well. You talk about the highwayman's pensions, the dandy highwayman's pensions for cross dressing.
Yes,
people like Mole Cutpurse and Tom Rowland both are cross dressing in either direction as highway people. And there's also mention of Lady Catherine Farrow, the wicked lady, as she is. Highwaymen, they do again play a sort of a romantic role in our sort of like idea of Britishness, even though these people were these people weren't Robin Hood by any means.
No, not at all. I mean, Watling Street riddled with highwaymen, you know, it all up and down. It was mainly Lady Catherine Ferris that I choose to write about because she lived right on Watling Street. But she was a good she's not a typical example, because she was a society lady. She was rich, she was wealthy, her house looks amazing if you go past it. But she had this secret door in her boudoir that led to a secret room where she put on men's clothing, men's highwayman clothes, that had a staircase so she could sneak out the house unobserved. And she'd just ride out across England doing whatever she liked, you know, robbing.
It's like the bat cave.
A bat cave for bad. And it wasn't because she needed money or anything like that. She just did it for the thrill of it, you know, for the real sort of buzz of it. And she was shot quite young, about age 26. Most men and women of the road, you know, had very short careers. When you look at the reality of it and compare it to the myth, there's such a gulf. Dick Turpin, as you say, was a really sort of horrible, horrible, vicious rapist, murderer. Well, I'm not sure about murderer. Terrible, but nothing good you could say about him. But we just romanticise him, you know, quite so much. And there's this sort of sense that they're all sort of stepped outside of society, they'd stepped outside of the rules. And this is where the cross-dressing thing seems to come in. Obviously, Lady Catherine Ferrers would dress as a man. Mole Cutpurse, you mentioned, would dress. She was brilliant, Mole Cutpurse. I think she was mainly a thief and a fence, but I think she was about 60 when she decided to become a highwayman. She'd always dressed as a man her entire life. That was just how she was. But she was a monarchist. at the time of the Civil War, so she'd only hold up parliamentarians. That was her rule. Tom Reynolds, you mentioned, was a man who always dressed as a woman, and he would ride side saddle unless he had to get away. And the descriptions of people like Tom Reynolds, they'd sort of say, oh, well, he dressed as a woman, probably it was a disguise. And now we look at this and we go, oh, these people are transgender. It's quite clear to us now. It sort of makes total sense. And the only way you could be at that time would be to step outside mm-hmm. of society as they were doing. And it gives a weird insight into this particular point of our history, because most of the highwaymen we think of, it tends to be around the Civil War period or the decades afterwards, so into the 18th century as well, but less and less. It's much more concentrated on that. We had highwaymen up until the age of rail, really, mm-hmm. but we don't sort of ignore that, focus much on that. It's this, they're very much linked to this time of chaos, you know, when we chopped the head off the king, you know, all the normal systems of structures, the way we understood ourselves, was just thrown out the window. It was a time when all the old rules ended and we hadn't, didn't know what the new rules were, and it was people were free to do whatever. There was the ranters, there was groups like the levellers and the diggers, and there was groups who were very much who believed that they were incapable of sin, so they were free to have sex with whoever they liked. And it's like a real sort of, it was like the 60s counterculture about 300 years too early. There was this real, yeah, the chopping the head off the king did a lot of strange things to the national psyche, it must be said. It's the highwaymen are sort of tied into.
I'm Jeff Dyer. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Just coming back to London briefly, I just wanted to talk about, I spent some time talking about the London Stone.
Mm.
This piece of rock.
Piece of rock, yeah.
I used to work years ago on Cannon Street, and I'm you know, very, very familiar with its rather sad little sort of hiding place in a little sort of like compartment in a building.
Yeah.
Before it was moved over to the Museum of London. This is a piece of rock that has, well, I was going to say outlived, that's the wrong word, but, you know, predated London itself.
Possibly, yeah, quite possibly. I mean, from the earliest references we have, there's a sense that it's, everybody knows about it because it's such an old thing at the time. Now it looks like a giant's tooth, really. It's a piece of limestone. But it used to be a much taller sort of thing. I think it was probably the Great Fire of London which mm-hmm. destroyed, made it much smaller than it is now. But it survived the Great Fire of London. It survived the Blitz. It's sort of always been there, and it's linked to the early founding myths of London. So mm-hmm. it's sometimes called the Brutus Stone after Brutus of Troy, who said to have founded London. And the saying is, so long as the Brutus Stone remains, then the city of London will be safe. And so that when they did move it, because the building it in is being rebuilt, they moved it to the Museum of London. It's literally just 5 minutes up the road. Mm-hmm. They had to try and work out how to insure it. Because what was it worth? You know, was it worth, like, you know, 19, you know, quid, which is what a lump of limestone that much would cost? Or was it worth 1.9 trillion, which is the turnover of the, you know, the City of London? It was complicated stuff, but they moved it a little bit. And in theory, that shouldn't have mattered because it was still in the City of London. But it's so old. It's so old that it predates the current boundaries of the City of London. And I just thought, I just had a notion that, hang on, what was the original boundaries? There was the Roman, they're marked by the Roman walls. And I got the map out and I looked where the Museum of London was.
London Wall.
Yeah, it's just north of London. It's they've moved it literally yards outside of the original City of London. And the moment they did that, right, Brexit happened. And to speak to anyone who works in the City of London, they'll just say, oh, it's over, City of London's over, without passport in rights, it's all going to collapse, they're all off to Frankfurt, off to Dublin, and the top end of the London housing market will collapse, and then the rest of the London housing market will collapse, it's all over, the City of London's finished. The moment that they move this stone that's been there for centuries just outside, all that sort of things happens. And, you know, and part of you goes, well, it's just a stone, right? It's just a rock. But this is the thing about myths. They don't know that they're not real. They just act out anyway. They just sort of, you know, behave. And I take great comfort in the fact that I think some point next year they're going to move it back. The building work will be finished and it'll leave the Museum of London and go back to 111 Cannon Street, which is its home. So I'd be very curious as to see what happens to the plans for Brexit in the City of London when they've moved this stone back. I know it's daft to pin such hopes on myths, but they do seem to pay out in some strange ways.
Okay, just one other thing to finish off, and there's lots of this book that we haven't talked about, the Crossbones Cemetery in London, a visit to Dunstable as a sort of archetypal Brexit town, should we say, a tour around Northampton with Alan Moore.
Yeah, yeah.
But I want to finish about talking about, you know, the country, and a theme that keeps sort of recurring is actually, you know, we could talk about the identity, you know, feeling some sort of identity, some sort of identification with it.
Mm.
But of course, who actually owns it?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to finish off talking about the possibility of a land tax, basically, John, but I think it's such a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, when I was writing the book, as I say, I was trying to take a neutral... You can't take a neutral tone. It's absolutely impossible. You can try to take a neutral tone, and it tends to sort of work a little bit better. And I was very aware that the book was suggesting new ways to look at the country, and I was very aware the book wanted the odd concrete example here and there, and the idea of a land tax seemed the obvious one to do out of what, I mean, any sort of change in taxation is going to have winners and losers, right? But there's no change that would have, you know, more winners and less losers than the land tax, because the way the land ownership in this country works, well, I'm not sure works even in the right idea. There's large parts of this country we just don't know who owns. Mm-hmm. Right? The land registry don't know who owns these things. They're put into trusts so that they can be passed through generations. I mean, the Duke of Westminster died and is a couple of years ago now, and is I think it was his third oldest child inherited it. The boy, basically. It couldn't go to a girl, you know, the title and all, and had to go to a boy. Completely, none of it taxed or anything like that, because it was in a particular trust. And land has become more and more used for speculation, for speculative. If you own land and if it's in a position to be farmed, it doesn't have to be farmed, but if it's in a condition where it could be farmed, you get all this money from the EU. So you get a lot of sort of people from Saudi Arabia, sort of rich Americans, just buying up all land around Europe and in Britain that we could kind of use to sort of, you know, build houses on or something like that. If
we're going to need to grow food on it if we leave Europe.
To grow food on it, yeah. I mean, the age of farmers is crazy now. You hear statistics, the average age of farmers is about 16, because there's all these young farmers, they just can't afford the land because the price has been massively, massively hoiked by people buying land to hoard. Right, not to use. And in a number of places around the world, they have a land value tax. Australia's one, and it's generally seen as a very, very fair tax because you can't hide land.
Yeah, you can't dodge it.
And you can, you know, if you want some land to, you know, raise cows or something like that, then there's a small tax to pay and things like that. But that's sort of fine. So you only really have land if you've got a use for it. It's a really fascinating. I say it's a fascinating subject. It's a very hard to portray in a fascinating way. If you I want to talk to you about a land value tax, you know, people are just going to really, really switch off. But the more you look at it, the more you go, yeah, that's really sort of, yeah, I get that. That would make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And it's more a sense that the country is there for us. There was Lloyd George who said, "Who is it? I forget the exact phrase, but who is it who made these 10,000 people as owners of the land of your birth when the rest of us sort of have nothing? We're sort of born onto this country, but it's owned by someone else, right? So that you can't sort of eke a living on it. It's owned by someone. We're sort of kept off the place where we're born. If there was a land value tax, then it sort of shifts the whole understanding the country is there to support everyone, you know. Yeah. And it's all the idea that you own land is kind of ridiculous, you know. It's been there for thousands and centuries, and they will be there for much later, and you come and go very, very quickly. It sort of changes the way you think about it. Yeah. I appreciate it can come across as a very sort of dry sort of topic, but it's
well, as I said, I think it's such a great idea that self-indulgently I thought we'd finish off the conversation spending some time talking about that. So okay, so I've been talking to John Heggs and we've been talking about his latest book, Watling Street. John, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with us.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.